And so let's begin this sitting with closing your eyes and sitting upright. When the mind is agitated or energized, distracted, it can often be useful to use the breathing in different ways as a way of collecting the mind, stabilizing it. And there's many different ways of meditating on the breath. And I'd like to kind of begin this sitting with a particular form of breath meditation. Then maybe you could find useful, maybe at the beginning of sittings or at times when the mind's particularly active. So as always, begin by taking an alert spine, sitting up straight, feeling carefully your lower vertebrae, having some strength there in the lower back as you sit. And feeling the alignment of your weight along your lower spine. Sit back a little bit if you need to, or forward a little bit, in such a way that the weight of your body seems to go through the lower spine. And then work your way up the spine the best you can, both to energize the spine a little bit, but also to align it and see if you can get the weight of your body centered there along the spine. And then take a few long, deep breaths as a way of connecting to your body, as if your inhalations arise from deep inside your body and expand outwards as you breathe in. And then as you breathe out, relaxing and settling into your body, letting go. And letting your breath be normal. And then taking a few moments to wander around your body with your attention, searching out for any places you might feel some tension or holding. And then as you exhale, see if you can soften or relax those places, even if it's just a teeny bit. And then develop a global awareness of your body. Become aware of as wide a full feeling of being in a body as you can. The widest sense of presence within your body. Again, letting your attention wander a little bit. So at different moments, you're aware of different aspects of this global presence. Sometimes the fullness of the legs, sometimes the arms, torso, the head. Sometimes, in a sense, the whole show. And then within the body, as part of the body, become aware of the breath body. The breath body being the widest, fullest sense, feelings of breathing that you can feel in your body. A lot more is much of the body's involved with breathing. The rippling sensations of expansion, contraction, pressure and release of pressure. Movement that occurs as you breathe occurs throughout the torso, the rib cage, the back rib cage, collarbone, shoulders, stomach. Sometimes you feel it in the throat, in the mouth, in the nose. See if you can get as large a global awareness as possible of the expansion of breathing in and the contraction of breathing out. The full breath body. The side of your rib cage, next to your arms. Feeling the alternating rhythm of breathing in and breathing out, the expansion, the pressure of breathing in, the release and the coming together, the contraction as you breathe out. How low into your body can you feel the breathing? Can you feel the changing senses of pressure down into the pelvic cavity, into your sitting bones as you touch your seat? Maybe you can feel the breath body be kind of like a massage from the inside of your body. The inhalation is the pressure of the massage. Exhalation is the release of the whole breath body. Perhaps you feel the whole body breathing. Each time you exhale, remember to let go of any thoughts that have arisen. Relaxing the brain. As you breathe in and out through the whole breath body, the whole body of breathing, let that breath body relax you, calm you, calming the body, the mind. Thank you. as if each time you breathe in and out, you're relaxing all your pores. Letting the breath body be quite expansive, quite large, larger than any concerns you might have, any feelings or thoughts, emotions, sensations in your body. Take refuge in this expansive feeling of breathing in and out, that maybe you can feel as being larger than anything else. If your breathing becomes very subtle and quiet sitting here, let your mind become as still as possible so that your sensitivity can match the subtlety of the breath. Be aware of the switching over between breathing in and breathing out, and breathing out and breathing in. If you're struggling with anything or resisting anything, fully acknowledge what it is. And in that acknowledgement, perhaps put it to rest to some degree. Accept it. And then return to the breath body, seeing if you can let the breath encompass, be larger than the concern. And in the last few minutes of this sitting, let go of any special attention to your breathing. And just rest here in your awareness. Seeing if the best you can stay in the present moment with your awareness. Without any agenda of what the present moment experience should be. Letting yourself be as you are, but being aware of what that is, moment by moment. And then in a few moments, I'm going to ring the bell to end the sitting. I'll ring the bell 3 times. Listen to the sounds of the bell. And then after the 3rd ring, bring your attention to your eyes. And when you're ready, open your eyes and let seeing happen on its own. Notice and just notice the experience of the objects of the room coming to your eyes, arriving effortlessly. And then be attentive to what happens to you in the 30 or so seconds after opening your eyes. So, welcome back to the fifth week of the course, and back from your meditation, wherever you might have gone. And so this is the last week of the five-week introductory course of meditation, and I brought some handouts again there on the, hopefully some left there on the back chair. And kind of to a little bit review, what we've talked about in terms of meditation is that the mindfulness practice is basically a practice of noticing what's happening in the present moment. And in a sense, it's nothing more sexy than that. The word mindfulness is kind of popular, trendy lately. Mindfulness this and mindfulness that. And so it's kind of cool, you know, to go do something, be mindful and do mindfulness things. But to do noticing, that's not cool at all. You know, someone asks you, what's this great spiritual practice you're doing? Oh, I notice things. That's not going to go over very well. But that's good. Because you want to do a spiritual practice, you're not going to get any credit for. Because if you get credit for it, then if you're taking credit for it, then it's not spiritual. So I do a noticing practice, you can say, and just leave it at that. So the basic idea of mindfulness is just to notice what's happening in the present moment as it's happening. What you find is that it's difficult to stay in the present moment. The mind wants very quickly to go into thoughts about the future, about the past, fantasy, planning, justification. We get entangled. Even if we stay in the present, then we're entangled with the present moment. Maybe we're very present for what's happening, but we're judging it and criticizing it, condemning it, wanting it, resisting it, trying to manipulate it. We do things with what's going on in the world. And there's nothing maybe inherently wrong, maybe nothing wrong with that in some circumstances, but to always do it and always live under the compulsion to do it means a person is not free. And to have the ability to sit still or to be still with the awareness and just be attentive and aware without complicating it with any judgments or interpretations or commentary or bias or whatever is moving in the direction of freedom. So it's basically a noticing practice where we try to notice things clearly, simply, as they are. One of the kind of cliches in Buddhism is that the practice of Buddhism is to see things as they are. And most of us, even if we see things, we don't necessarily see things as they are. We see them through the filter of our interpretations and concepts that we add to it. And I'll say a little bit more about that in a few minutes. So it's basically a noticing practice. However, the mind tends to wander off a lot very easily. It's very hard to be present in a clear way. So meditation practice is a training to help develop that ability to be in the present moment, to be attentive in the present moment, to notice things in this unbiased, unreactive way. And for meditation practice, it's often useful to begin with something as simple as the breathing. A few people, the breathing doesn't work, and so they use some other primary object as a kind of a grounding, the stabilizing object of their meditation. But generally, people use the breath, and they use the breath in various ways to settle, to relax, to help them train the mind, or strengthen the mind's ability to stay in the present moment. The mind wanders off, which it'll do, absolutely. Rather than judging that or being upset, we come back to the breath. And slowly the mind learns to stay with the breath and stay in the present moment, and slowly begins to lose interest in all the tantalizing, seductive thoughts which it wants to run off into. However, mindfulness is not just simply staying with the breath. Mindfulness is noticing whatever is occurring in the present moment. So from the basis in meditation, the basis of this mindfulness of breathing, if something else arises in your meditation that's more compelling than the breath, kind of pulls on your attention, is demanding to your attention, then the instruction is let go of the breath and bring your full meditative awareness to notice that experience, to bring your full attention to it, to look at it very carefully, to feel it very carefully, sense it, to really be present for it as intimately as you can. But also in a way that's not reactive, judgmental, interpretive, Just the facts, thank you. Just how it is in and of itself. So if strong sensations arise in the body, then we bring our attention to those strong sensations. And you might become aware of your reactions, your desires for more of the good sensation or your aversion to it. And the training is a training not to get caught up in those reactions, to stay free of those reactions. Doesn't mean you have to get rid of them, but you want to be free of them so you can continue with your meditative noticing of what's happening, meditative presence of what's happening. Being really close, feeling those sensations carefully in the body, feeling how they change. If strong emotions arise, then the instructions are, let go of the breath and bring your full attention to those emotions. In and of themselves, just the simplicity of the emotions, seeing if you can have an uncomplicated relationship to the emotions, just allowing them to be there. But then noticing how they are. And noticing means, in a sense, the ability to be aware of something in a meditative way is a step out of the reactive way of being with something. And most of us live in our reactivity, in our thoughts, our judgments, our feelings about what's happening. But the awareness itself is actually much more simple, more basic, and more, maybe it's not a good word, but more pure. As we come back to this very simple ability to know, to be aware, it's actually very restful if you get the hang of it. So to be aware of that emotion, just as it is. If there's a lot of thoughts that come up, then we notice the thinking. And again, in this meditative way, just thinking is happening. If the thinking is strong, if the emotions are strong, ground your awareness in the body, which means feel how the body is expressing those feelings or those thoughts. Feel the energetics of it, feel what happens in your muscles, the tension, the tightening, the loosening, the softness, whatever it might be. So the idea is that we use the breath as the anchor or the stabilizer. Coming back to the breath, it's kind of like the default. We come back to the breath whenever we can. But then we're ready to and alert to be attentive to anything else that arises that seems to want your attention, seems to call for your attention. If sounds occur and they're really loud, then you bring your attention to listening meditation, just do sounds. And the idea in mindfulness meditation is you can then bring your attention to the full spectrum of your human experience. There's nothing which is outside of the meditation. There's nothing which you need to keep outside of your meditative awareness. Your whole humanity can be included in this meditative awareness. Your whole humanity, all your experiences, anything that you can call an experience, can be noticed, can be an object of awareness, and so can be brought into this big field of awareness. And if you get a little bit mystical about it, in some schools of Buddhism, they talk about the big mind. Most of us live in the little mind, the small mind, of kind of claustrophobic mind of me, myself, and mine, and our reactions and our judgments and our opinions. But the big mind is that awareness, which in a sense, in a kind of almost like a mystical sense, is larger than anything else around you, but which receives everything or holds everything within it. So in this kind of mystical language, they would say, this room, you're not in this room, but the room is in you. And how they would say that is that, of course, the room is outside you. I mean, they're not going to argue with physics. But in the world of our direct experience, the experience of the room and the people in the room is happening at the sense doors. And how the mind interprets the sense doors. The whole world is happening in the contact with awareness. So in a sense, then when Buddhism talks about the big mind, they're talking about this mind that holds it all, kind of like a big screen, or a big mirror is probably a better analogy, a big mirror that can reflect anything that is in front of the mirror. And what we learn to do is to relate to the whole mirror, in a sense, rather than what's in the mirror. If we're always focusing on what's in the mirror, the reflections in the mirror, then the world gets kind of small and tight. But if you're aware of the whole mirror of awareness, the big mind, life can occur within it, and there can be much more feeling of grace and ease. So everything's included, whether you understood this mystical little description or not. The idea is to bring your attention to whatever arises, and nothing needs to be excluded. And because nothing needs to be excluded, Buddhists say that it's possible to become free in any experience you have. Because freedom does not mean the absence of some experience. It means resting in the awareness of that experience. Resting in an awareness which is unreactive. An awareness which is unbiased. An awareness which is unswayed and uncomplicated and unagitated by the experience. So it's kind of like a mirror. The mirror seems too static for a human being, perhaps. But it's kind of like a mirror. It doesn't care what comes in front of it. If some beautiful object comes, the mirror reflects it. Some ugly object comes, the mirror reflects it. If something that, you know, if a beautiful object disappears from the mirror's sight, the mirror doesn't care. The mirror just reflects what's there. And this ability just to notice what's there is really a doorway into becoming free and having a much more feeling of grace with life. So mindfulness is very helpful in many ways. It's helpful for pain management, for stress management. It's helpful because you can actually bring your attention to feel the physical pain, to feel the stress, and in feeling and being right there for it and not being reactive to it, it tends to begin to relax. It's helpful because we start noticing some of the causes of pain and stress. Sometimes pain is exacerbated by the way in which we resist it. Sometimes stress is caused by certain feelings or certain ideas, interpretations of what I need to accomplish, what I need to be, what other people expect of me. And we see kind of the cognitive roots of how we get tense. And you see the causes and we can begin to let go of them. However, mindfulness is much more. Mindfulness in its Buddhist context is much more than just simply becoming mindful. In this Buddhist context, it's a path to what Buddhists call liberation or awakening. It's a path towards kind of getting in touch with the deepest wellsprings of compassion within us. So there are two general ways. I want to say it this way. So now I've kind of, hopefully adequately enough, laid out the basic instructions for mindfulness over the first 4 weeks. There are two ways of continuing the practice once you get a sense of the basics of it. And if you have a daily meditation practice, one is to expand the mindfulness into our daily life so that the mindfulness is not just simply something you do in meditation practice, but something you bring to all your dealings in daily life. And sooner or later, people who meditate on a regular basis will discover that the mind in meditation and the mind outside meditation is the same mind. And to make a firm boundary or barrier between meditation time and daily life time is arbitrary, unnecessary, and maybe even unuseful. And what that means is that often people then will begin wanting to spill over, to extend or expand the mindfulness, the peace, the calm, the insight they get on the cushion into their daily life. They want to see if the integrity of mind, integrity of heart that can be discovered in meditation, if that can also be played out in daily life. You can live that way in daily life. If not only do we pay careful attention to meditation, but we pay careful attention in our daily life, in all our doings and what we're doing. So one way of developing the practice is taking an interest in how to become more mindful in our daily life. And there's many ways of doing that. But the first important criteria is you have to want to do that and feel that it's important. Important enough to apply yourself to doing it. And certainly it can be said you start doing it. You start paying more attention to what's happening in the present as you're doing it. As you're cooking, washing dishes, shopping, driving, talking on the phone, showering, whatever you're doing, to come back to the present moment experience instead of letting the mind wander off wherever it wants to go. Some people will choose certain areas of their life to focus on for a week or 2 weeks at a time, in order to kind of, rather than trying to be mindful of their whole daily life all the time, which seems like kind of daunting to task, is they'll choose small segments of their life to make it kind of a more make it their practice and more focus. So some people might choose cooking. Some people might choose eating. You know, one meal a day, I'm going to try to eat mindfully, as mindful as I can, maybe even in silence. Cooking, I'm going to turn off the radio and just be really present for cooking and be mindful and try to stay in the present moment. Or maybe driving, just whenever you drive, or a particular route that you drive to work and back. There's many different areas of life you can choose. And what some people will do is they'll choose different areas in different weeks and slowly kind of build the repertoire of things where they start developing more presence for, more alertness for. There's all kinds of cues that people use to help them to be mindful. And some of you might find it interesting to use cues. They can be kind of cute, the cues. I've heard of people who've taken little round stickers and stuck them all over. And then in the course of the day, they come across them. So, what's happening right now? And that's the reminder to pay attention. I used to use doorways a lot. Whenever I used to go through a doorway, I would use that as a reminder to be mindful, because my mind was off somewhere else or in a hurry to get someplace. And I'd come back and notice what was going on in my body, my feelings, my thoughts. And that was very helpful for me to do that. Some people like using the telephone. Some people have the practice of rushing and answering the phone as quickly as you can, because if you don't get it on the first ring, then it's a personal failing, or I don't know. But some people will wait until let it ring 4 or 5 times, trusting the other person's patience, and use those 4 rings at a time just to breathe and be present and stop and notice what's going on. And maybe that way, when you start answering the phone and talking, you're more likely to really be present and know what you're feeling, what your dispositions are, what's going on with you, and that might filter or color that conversation. So there's many ways of developing a daily practice, but that's one of the ways. One of the ways of developing the mindfulness practice beyond a daily sitting practice. The other route of developing the practice is to develop a greater level of concentration to join together with the mindfulness. Now, some concentration comes naturally. If you just kind of every day do your meditation practice, coming back to the breath and just being present, coming back to the present, the mind will slowly get stabilized and more easily calmed and more easily focused. And so you're developing concentration. But it's also possible to develop concentration much more strongly. And one of the preeminent ways of doing that is to go on retreats. Our tradition offers a lot of retreats. They go from anywhere from half day to day long retreats to 10-day retreats to 3-month retreats. And these are silent retreats where people go in meditation for the duration. And this is one of the great ways of developing a stronger concentration. Because the more concentrated your mindfulness is, the more clearly you can see what's actually going on. When the mind is not very concentrated, we tend to kind of not see things clearly. We tend to see things through the filters of our interpretations and judgments and concepts. But the greater the concentration, the more deeply we can penetrate what's actually happening in the present moment. And the more easy it is to free the mindfulness from our subjective biases and all that. So to develop the practice in daily life and to develop concentration with a meditation are the two primary routes of developing the practice. As our interpretation of that experience, our commentary, our judgments, or whatever it is. And often for most people, that distinction is not very clear. If someone, if I'm waiting for someone for a date, and the person doesn't show up, and the person hasn't shown up in the past also for dates, it'd be very easy to come to the conclusion that the person is a, you know, lousy schmuck. And how could they, him, he, she have stood me up one more time? And this is, you know, and so we very quickly come to interpretation of what this means and what's actually happening. It might be the person's a schmuck, but it could also be, you don't know. You don't have that as evidence, just the fact they didn't show up. It has happened to many people, I think, of having some kind of experience like that, where maybe they get angry, only to find out later that there was a good cause why they didn't show up. They were in an accident or something. And then all the anger disappears, and you realize that, oh, that was an interpretation. It wasn't actually what was going on. And most of us live in the interpretive world most of the time. The sense of self we have, the idea, the self-image, the self-concern we have, often belongs to that world of interpretation, and it's not really the world of how things actually are. And as we learn to do the mindfulness practice, we begin feeling more at home in the way things actually are, as opposed to the concepts we add to the way things are. So this is the example I like to use. And there's a famous Zen story where someone holds up a flower to teach. So I hold up a flower. And the flower by itself is a flower, and maybe you'll appreciate it if you see it. It's kind of nice, it's white. And you might ask, you know, what's he up to? This is kind of odd, showing a flower. So this is a flower. But if I take another flower and put next to it, then something new has happened, you can see, that didn't exist before. Now I can say, this is the big flower, this is the small flower. The smallness and bigness of these flowers doesn't exist in the flowers in and of themselves. It exists in our mind's ability to compare. It's the comparing mind is able to say that. And to show you that I'm a great magician with great psychic powers, all I have to do is hold up this flower, kind of flower, and now suddenly, what was the big flower before has become the small flower. Right in front of your eyes, not even a sleight of hand. Now that is powerful magic, right? The smallness and bigness of the flower only exists in the mind that compares things. But when you don't compare it to anything, when you see a thing in and of itself, it just is what it is. Some of you might still be thinking, what's Gil up to here? What's the point of this, showing flowers? Not a botany class. Most of the ways in which we suffer around our sense of self belongs to this realm of comparative thinking. We compare ourselves to standards, to values, to other people, and we measure ourselves. So if I told you I'm a lousy basketball player, after this little lesson, of course, you would now know to say, compared to what? I mean, you could, of course, just say, commiserate with me and say, well, it's too bad, I'm sorry to hear that. And just reinforce the fact that, you know, now you guys believe it's true too, therefore it must be really be true, right, that I'm a lousy basketball player. But if instead you ask, compared to what? And I said, oh, compared to Michael Jackson. Is that Michael Jordan? To Michael Jordan. See, I don't watch football, basketball, so Michael Jordan, right? So, you know, of course I'm lousy compared to him. Compared to Michael Jackson, I don't know. I might be hot stuff. Certainly the 8-year-old that lives down the street, I'm much better than him. What's hidden, and often our judgments is hidden, is we're actually making a comparison, and we don't often question what the comparison is. And maybe it's a valid comparison. However, does our sense of self, our sense of personal well-being, have to be tied up with a comparison? Or can we rest in who we are in and of ourselves, independent of comparison? Body image. most of us, most I think, have had some problems with some parts of our body. It's either too big or too small or too much of it or too little of it, or too long or too short, or not, you know, whatever. You know, there's a whole bunch of things. You know, the noses, the eyes, the ears, the forehead. I used to measure my forehead when I was in junior high school to make sure that it wasn't receding. And most of those concerns have to do with comparisons we make. Our nose, our forehead, our thighs, our bellies. If you just be present for them as they are, you probably find that they're actually quite comfortable. But if you get into the thoughts and the comparisons, then you can get depressed pretty quickly. So the meditative awareness is an awareness which tries to see things as they are, as opposed to seeing things through the filter of all the comparisons and ideas and judgments, the concepts. And that's one of the reasons why meditation can be so restful. Because most of the mental strain, there's a lot of mental strain and stress in taking up these comparisons, taking up these concepts, reacting to them, holding on to them, arguing with them, and learning to put all that to rest and just letting things be as they are in meditation or in mindfulness is really freeing. It brings a lot of ease and joy. So this ability to see things as they actually are in Buddhism is considered to be a very important spiritual undertaking. And maybe the reason it's called a spiritual undertaking is that it's really very different than where most of us place our concerns. Most of us will take up residence in the judgments and the comparisons and the reactions, the responses, the ideas. And we live in all that world, much more than maybe we even want to admit. And Buddhism says that there is an alternative to that. You don't have to live in all that. You can have it, but you can use it wisely, perhaps, but you don't have to live in it. You can take residence in something that is much more peaceful, more compassionate, more loving. And that which is more peaceful and loving and compassionate belongs to the world of awareness, of this unreactive meditative awareness. So to practice mindfulness in a serious way for Buddhists is to learn to come back to this tremendous capacity we have to be present, to be mindful, and from that to have compassion and love arise from it. Buddhists put a lot of emphasis on awakening, on liberation, kind of the synonymous terms. In a sense, liberation and awakening is considered in Buddhism to be some of the highest goal, the highest ideal. And when Buddhists engage in mindfulness practice, they do it as a path of practice. Buddhism is offered as a path. In Chinese and Japanese culture, they have the notion of the Tao. Or the Do, like Aikido, the way of Aiki, Judo, the way of Ju. There's a Do, it means a way, a path. That is not simply something you kind of pick up here and there, but it's a path that you follow, it's a way that you kind of live your life. In secular terms, people will take up mindfulness as a way to support their life, to help their life out. In Buddhist terms, we try to figure out how our life can support our mindfulness. So it's kind of reversed. See the difference? And it's either one is fine, but the tendency is that if it's mindfulness is used to support our life, that then we're using it still to support something in the world of comparative thoughts, some sense of self and me and mine that is part of the comparative world of concepts and ideas. To become free of that world, it's better to think of how do I make my life, live my life in such a way that it's supportive of this kind of awareness, this liberation, this freedom of awareness. How can I develop the capacity to be luminously, independently, unreactively, peaceful, present, aware, in all my dealings and all my doings as I go about my life? How can I move my life in that direction? And it's a path, so it's maybe a path that maybe doesn't move very fast for some people it's fast, but it's a path that people then begin to follow. And it's possible to be inspired to move in that direction. It's said that, it's often said that if you want to do a regular meditation practice, it's often valuable if you from time to time come and sit with other people. You don't just do it by yourself. And there's some personal reasons for that. One is that if you're always meditating by yourself, it sometimes can be conducive to developing some bad habits. If you come occasionally to sit with other people, another group, meditation group or something, we tend to learn by osmosis, just from the other people we sit with. Something about the way they sit, something about the way they carry themselves, something about the feeling in the room. That really often helps the meditation process itself. So if you're serious about meditation, I'd encourage you to go from time to time, maybe you know once a week, once a month, or whenever, to find some meditation group that works for you. You can certainly come to our groups here. We have sittings here Thursdays. This Thursday program just continues after the intro class is over, and you're welcome to come back on Thursdays. And in a sense, the first Thursdays after the end of the intro class, I continue as if it never ended. So I continue with themes that kind of build on what we talked about so far. The Monday group, the Saturday, Sunday morning, the Monday evening. There's a Zen center in Mountain View. There's a Zen sitting group I know in Redwood City. There's a sitting group, mindfulness sitting group in San Jose. There are sitting groups, you know, all over, scattered. And to go around and find one that seems compatible with you is a nice thing to do. That's probably enough for me. Talk what?
Talk about
Monday. Yeah, I think those things will be in a little bit. So, any questions you might have? Please.
Does the quality of being in a meditation group, how much is there? Do you get more from more active participation, or just from the osmosis effect?
I think I should let that for each individual to find out for themselves. More actively involved means what?
I don't know. But it seems more than just coming and sitting and then leaving at the end of the night.
So it's very valuable to begin to know other people who are meditators or on a path. A meditation practice will often change the meditator, and sometimes their values will change, and their priorities will change, and it can be very hard if our values and priorities change, and we're still hanging out with all the same people who are going in a different direction. So, I mean, if your whole life has been about making money as quickly as you can in Silicon Valley, and all your friends want to make money and retire whenever. and they're all scheming and talking about day trading and this and that and what companies to buy and you know whatever you know, and suddenly you discover there's more to life than making money. And then you go to your friends and like they just want to talk about money. You say, well, you know, that's nice, but I'm tired of that. I'd rather you know talk about you know something different. And it can be kind of hard. Or there's many, many values that might shift. So to have some contact, or actually know some people personally, make some friends or something in a meditation group, so that you have some other people who have a reference that you're not crazy. The Buddha said that people who follow the path are going against the popular current. And so in that, in the, if that's the case, then you want to know at least a few other people are going against the current too, of consumerism and materialism and whatever it might be. So be more actively involved by making some friends and connections. And in our sitting groups that we have, it's not that easy to make connections with people, because most of the people come together to sit quietly and listen to, you know, me or a teacher. And it's one of our shortcomings. Some people love that, that we're organized that way. Some people say that it's quite refreshing that they can just come in through that door and nothing's asked of them, and they just sit in the back and no one bugs them, and you know, nothing's required, and they can leave and no one's ever talked to them, and what a relief. But other people, especially they come for a while, would like to make some contact. And most people are very friendly, so you just take initiative, it'll go a long way. But also if you just keep coming on a regular basis, I think within at some point, maybe a little bit slower than most conventional gatherings of people, you'll start recognizing people and making connections and meeting people and talking. And there's also from time to time talking to a meditation teacher. It's one way, another way of being actively involved. I think if someone practices quite diligently by themselves, you know, sitting every day for a long time, occasionally, sooner or later, it's a good idea to go check in with someone who's more experienced than you. It can be someone who's much more senior in the practice, been around for a long while, longer, or it can be someone who's considered a teacher. And just simply, it doesn't have to be any question even, but it can be, this is what I do in my meditation, this is what happens to me, this is why I do it, and just kind of lay out and see what that teacher might say in response. Might give some interesting feedback, or if you have some questions. We have one-day sittings here in Palo Alto almost once a month, and that's a great time to come and talk to, if I'm leading it, to come and talk to a teacher about your practice. Sometimes you can come and talk to me if you come here at the end of one of our sittings. Sometimes there's not too many people want to talk to me, that can be done. And there's other teachers around. Les Kay is a Zen teacher in Mountain View, is quite a wonderful teacher, and Misha in Redwood City, and Mary Orr in Santa Cruz, and all the Spirit Rock teachers for the north. Yes.
Along the lines of, you know, overweight, for instance, and you know, if you're 20 or 30 pounds overweight, yes, comparing yourself to someone else can be problematic, but say also, well, it would be better for me if I lost that weight. You know, now you're running off into the future. So I don't know what context to kind of put all that in terms of, you know, maybe it makes sense that if I purely just am, then hey, it doesn't matter.
That's an interesting question. We have to make all kinds of decisions about what to do and what we hope will happen. That's part and parcel of life. Mindfulness is not supposed to be a substitute for decisiveness and planning and such things. That has to happen. But if in the meditation practice you can learn how to come to zero, if you can learn how to be at home and be at peace and have this deep acceptance of the present moment that doesn't need anything else to happen. So you're not reactive. You're not living out of fear or compulsion or preoccupation about some way of being a certain way. But you kind of come back to zero. If you have that ability to come to zero, then you can use that zero point as a reference point for understanding how you begin reacting or responding, or how you're judging and what decisions are coming into play. Because when someone's 30 pounds overweight, there can be a lot of different motivations for losing weight. Certainly it can be, it's better for my health to lose some weight. But also it can be tied in with self-image very easily. It can be tied in with, you know, what is it to be overweight? I mean, it's a little bit of a cultural phenomena too. What's overweight in the 90s? Or what are we now, in the zeros? So what are we called? In the zeros? What? The aughts. what was overweight, you know, nowadays is a lot different than what it was in the 1950s. In the 1950s, people were a little bit heavier. So women, for example, a little bit heavier. Admirable women were heavier set than they were in the 90s. And they weren't overweight. They just were, you know, different values. So mindfulness, if you can come back to zero, then you can maybe notice very honestly what's actually motivating the decision you're making. So mindfulness might not help you in the decisions you have to make, but if you can get to that zero point or close to it, it helps clarify what's actually going on within you. Make sense? So at least it means that at least in one place in your life, maybe at least in your meditation practice, that's the place where you're willing to unconditionally accept who you are and what's going on in the present moment. At least in that place, come to zero. Nothing has to happen. I can be 300 pounds overweight here. It's okay in my meditation. Stephanie.
You become, just practicing meditation, you become more aware of why you're eating, your motivation behind the eating itself, and that helps you try to connect with the food.
Also, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes.
I can see how mindfulness would support your life, but how do you recognize if your life is supporting mindfulness?
Good. I think it would be to begin looking at how you live your life, the ways in which you live your life, and what the effect that has on your awareness, effect it has on you being present. So, for example, it can be as simple as, how do you drive your car? Do you practice mindfulness so you can be a really good hot dog driver? So you're really present, really be there for getting around those curves, you know, really fast. It helps. If you're a really, really fast race driver, it helps be mindful. You know, so I'm going to really do this mindfulness practice diligently because I'm going to be the best driver in Palo Alto. The other way to do it is say, okay, how am I going to drive my car in such a way that I develop my presence, my sensitivity, my calm? Okay, rather than being a hot dog driver, I think I'm actually going to drive at the speed limit for a while. And if I drive at the speed limit, that actually supports me. I actually find that I arrive in my destination much more settled and present and mindful. But if I drive twice the speed limit, then I notice what happens is I arrive with all this kind of momentum of energy and excitement. It's actually hard to slow down and pay attention. And there's many areas like that in our life we can look at. Yes?
How is it that developing mindfulness also develops compassion?
Compassion arises when we're present for suffering. So the compassion is not something that arises in the abstract. You know, you read a book, it says it's good to be compassionate. I don't feel very compassionate, so I'm going to try to be compassionate here. It doesn't work that way. Compassion arises when we're present for suffering, or in ourselves or in other people. And mindfulness is the practice of being present. And the more fully present you can be in this non-reactive way, the more you can allow a non-reactive response within you. And that non-reactive response tends to be empathy and compassion. If we're a little bit present for someone suffering, but we're caught up in our reactions to it, then there can be pity for the person, there can be horror, we can pull back, we can be full of fear. And that could be the main thing that's operating for us is our reactions. And in those reactions, there's very little space for real, full-blown compassion to arise. So as mindfulness kind of helps us be more non-reactive, as mindfulness helps us to show us where our reactivity is, we tend not to be so caught up by the reactivity, and there tends to be then space for a more full or compassionate. Compassion is almost as if it's the innate response of the heart to suffering. And the less veils of illusion and reactivity there are over the heart, the more it'll be naturally compassionate. So, it's for most people inevitably follows. Compassion and love come almost as a matter of course, as the practice deepens. If the person follows through on the practice enough, so it really deepens and changes them, most people will find that love and compassion become a greater part of their life. Yes, Dave.
Just going back to the driving example.
Yes.
Okay, say you want your life to support mindfulness, and you've noticed the way you've driven, you know, it's a little aggressive, you want to keep the speed limit. So now you impose on yourself to drive the speed limit. You really want to be strict with that, and because you really want to be mindful, or you really want to support mindfulness. But perhaps you start to get impatient, frustrated, because it's not really in your habits. You drive at that speed.
There might be a period of going through withdrawal symptoms. And so a certain degree, when there's these kinds of changes in our lives, sometimes we have to put up with a short period of some period of discomfort. And if we're not willing to put up with some discomfort in the transition, then there might not be any change at all. So that's one thing. But the other thing is, the way you worded it, you said, you used the word impose. It sounded very forced and controlling. And now I'm going to kind of do this technique in order to... I would be much more relaxed about it and see, rather than kind of... So rather than say, well, you know, what's helpful to be mindful and present? Well, driving slower is. But see if you can do it in a way that kind of comes from your ease. So when you arrive and when you sit down in your car, sit there for a moment and be mindful and feel your body and get a sense of what it'd be like to be at ease as you drive. Be aware of how tension begins to arise in your driving. And then let go of the tension. So it's not so much a matter of imposing then, but it's a matter of letting go of the doing which makes you drive fast. Because driving fast is a doing. So rather than adding another doing, forcing yourself into a tight box, let go of that doing which makes you drive fast. And then you won't feel like you're imposing something on you.
I find, not specifically with driving, but in trying to do that, it's something that, you know, I could do a lot at the beginning of when I first started to practice because it was new, and eventually finding that those periods of being at ease and sort of letting go of tension become shorter and shorter. You know, can't quite have the endurance, I guess, or, you know, and for me is to kind of just back off altogether.
So one of the important principles of mindfulness that's always important to keep in mind is that it's not so much, it's a little bit dangerous to kind of box yourself into something, try to make yourself into a certain way. Some ideal, I want to be mindful, for example. Okay, now I'm going to be mindful, thank you. It's very important to notice the forces within us that keep us from the ideal. So rather than just always trying to be mindful, what you want to do is notice those reactive forces inside of you that make it difficult to be mindful. And then take care of those, resolve those. So like, there's three ways of developing concentration. One is by accident. Sometimes people take credit for it, but just, you know, the weather was nice and they had a good meal and boom, they're concentrated. But the other way is by force. Will yourself, I'm going to stay focused and concentrate, I'm not going to leave this focus one moment. And that can work sometimes, but sometimes that leads to the person becoming a little bit hard. They can lead to problems when it's in a willed way. The other way is, rather than focusing on becoming concentrated, focus on all the things that keep you from being concentrated. And then really attend to them carefully. And as they get attended to and fall away, then you find yourself concentrated because you're not being pulled off in different directions. So if you want to drive in a way that's, you know, more sane, and you keep having, if you use this example again, and you keep finding it hard to drive slow enough, maybe what you really need to pay attention to is the feeling of compulsion to drive fast. And then really be present for that compulsion, really feel it and explore it and try to resolve it. And once it's resolved, then it's not a problem anymore to drive slower. So that makes sense?
Hey, because I've been exploring reactions come up, and it's there, and it seems better to be mindful of the reaction,
than imposing something on.
Or say impatience came up in the driving example. You can't let that impatience go, so just attend to the impatience.
Yes, but please, if it's driving, use your common sense too. if it's a school zone and it's 25 miles an hour and you need to go 60, don't just say, well, I'm just going to go by 60 and just deal, be mindful of that. So use your, what you're saying is fine, but use your common sense too.
I'm talking about sitting.
Okay. Yeah, sitting is a good place. See, one of the great things about meditation is that it's a safe place to let things just rip. Let things be as they are. There you don't have to, you don't have to worry about your impatience. Just let it be impatient. And then, you're not gonna hurt someone when you're sitting meditating, So you can let, the speed just kind of course through you. So that's why meditation is such a powerful place to learn who we are, because meditation is considered a safe place to let ourselves be as we are without needing to change it or fix it or run away from it or to judge it. We can just get out of our way and just let it all come, because it's really safe. It might not be so safe, elsewhere, but at least we have this one place, this refuge. Yes, last question.
I still have some concerns about my breathing, because when we say breathe normally, when I breathe normally, I'm not aware of it.
Uh-huh.
And then when I try to focus on my breathing, I tend to breathe kind of intently.
Yes.
And I think there is a difference between that and watching your breathing.
Yeah. What I'd encourage you to do is experiment with a little bit with your breathing. See if you can, and I'll give you some possible experiments. One is put your hand on your belly or your chest as you meditate, and maybe you'll feel movement then. And just meditate on the movement of the hand as the belly rises and falls, or the chest rises and falls. The other thing you might experiment with is, as you exhale, give a little bit extra push or letting go as you exhale. Kind of let yourself relax as you exhale. Let the exhalation be more full or complete. And if the exhalation is more complete, then in a natural way, without forcing anything, you'll take a little bit deeper in-breath. And then you might be more aware of what's going on with your breathing again.
But then again, it's not breathing normally.
For you,
if a person
can't find any sensations of breathing at all in their meditation, and they're pretty much a beginner in meditation, then it might be useful actually to emphasize their breath a little bit for a while. For various reasons, sometimes people don't. Some people hold their breath a lot, and so the reason they can't feel the breath is because actually the breath is kind of held and contracted. And so by breathing a little more fully, we begin massaging that contraction and relaxing. As we breathe out more fully, we relax that tension. Other people breathe breathe just fine, but there's kind of not so much in touch with their body. Some people are numb from the neck down, for example. And by breathing a little bit more fully, maybe you begin awakening some sensations. And then after doing that for maybe a week or something, after that it might be easier than to go back to just breathing normally again, and then you can be aware. So why don't you experiment and then let me know the outcome of your experiments. I would like to ask now from you, this is the first time that I've written up these handouts. Did you find them useful? Did anyone read them?
Yes.
Yeah, you found it useful? It was a good thing to do?
Yes.
And how many of you did those exercises? Some of them, huh? Should I emphasize them more the next time? So it's kind of, so not just the honor system? So, good. I'm glad you appreciated those handouts. And then Cheryl Gassner is going to talk to you for a couple of minutes. What we do at the end of the intro course is have some senior student from our sitting group come and talk to you for a minute about some of the various things that we do as a meditation community and how you might participate, both so you learn about what's going on and if you want to do things, but also so you can identify some other face besides mine as someone who's approachable. And you can go talk to Cheryl, and she's very friendly, and so it gives you a chance to meet some other people in our community. So Cheryl, please.
I'm going to stand up because my voice projects better. I just wanted to introduce you to the fact that we do have a newsletter, and if you look to the second page here, it has a list of events, scheduled events. And on it, you'll see things like our Monday night sitting, Thursday night sitting, Sunday sittings, and various times at which we hold potlucks. There's a children's program. And it's all here for you to read and to follow along, and you're welcome to participate and to use this as an opportunity to extend your practice and to learn more. And the other thing I'd like to let you know is we do have a mailing list. And I brought some of these forms. They're out there on the table, the literature table. And what I'd like for you to do is, if you would like to receive a newsletter, to please fill this out with your name, address, telephone number, and email, if you have. And then if you would like any information that you've written here to appear within a directory, which is available to other people who, members who come here, in order to contact one another, we would like for you to go ahead and just underline or circle the things you would like to appear in that directory. Because we don't publish our mailing list, but we do publish a directory. Is that clear? Okay. So if you there'll be some pens out there as well, and you can just grab any of these sheets and fill it out. And I know there's a lot of us who don't have to do it sequentially, so if you have your own pen, just go ahead and fill it out, but make sure you leave it here and I'll pick it up tonight. Okay? And I just want to say welcome and, very happy that you're here. And if I can answer any questions or any of the other students here, please let us know. Thank you.
Okay. And I might mention a couple of upcoming events. We have a lot of things that go on, and a lot of guest teachers come in, and different people who teach for us in different kind of events. Shaila Trumovich is teaching a series, 4-week series, on mindfulness of the body, different practices having to do with embodied practice, embodied spirituality. And that's a short class on Thursdays here in this room from 5:30 to 6:30. And so it was today, and then it'll be for the next three Thursdays, and you're welcome to come to that. That's quite nice. Shaila's a very good teacher. And then she's also teaching a one-day sitting for people in their 20s and 30s on the 18th of November. This is in the newsletter. And then on the 10th of November, which is a Friday evening, is the full moon. There's a full moon gathering for women in our community. And to be part of our community, you basically have to live in the peninsula or some, in the United States or something. We have, you know, who we are as a community is very open, so anybody's welcome to come. And but this is just for women. And something will nice, well, I guess, will happen when women meditating women get together. I'm not sure. There'll be some discussion and some various things happening. And so I want to thank you all.
I was writing. There's a one-day sitting this Saturday in San Jose.
Oh, in San Jose, this Saturday, Eugene Cash is doing a one-day retreat, one-day mindfulness retreat. And you can talk to Lewis here. He'll tell you more about that if you want to try out a retreat like that. The one-day sittings that I teach here in Palo Alto, there's two kinds, one from 9 o'clock to 4:30, which is probably most suitable for people who are brand new to retreat experience, because there's instructions given through the day. And the sitting's a little bit shorter. And you can come to half the day. You don't have to come for the whole day. And it's pretty informal. You just, like all our, most of our activities, just show up.
It's not here.
It's not here. It's at St. Mark's down the street. And then the other kind of one-day sitting's from 8:30 to 5. And there's no instructions given through in the day. There's a talk given at the end of the day. But that's the sitting's a little bit longer. And that's just a chance to be on retreat in silence for a day together with others and to engage in the practice. Yeah?
If you come to the one-day retreat for beginners and want to come in the afternoon, what time would you come?
Oh, if you come around 1 or 1:30, it's probably, you know, the 8:30 to 5 has a schedule. The 9 to 4:30, I make it up as we go along. So when lunch break is, it's variable. But if you come by 1, it's safe.
Also, does it say on the literature table how to get in touch with the Redwood City sitting group?
No. Misha Merrill, it's a Zen group. And I might have her phone number here. You can look up Misha Merrill in the phone book. Merrill is Merrill. And she might be listed in the phone book as M. Merrill.
It's an 851.
It's an 851 number.
Okay, thank you.
And also, I ask you to remember we have these donation baskets out by the door, which is an important way of supporting what we do here and makes it all possible. And I want to thank you all very much for this course. It was very nice to have you. The next course is starts January 4th. If I may, just one question again. We're thinking of doing the next course a little bit differently. We're always looking for ways of improving it. So the handouts was this time's. What we're thinking of doing next time is to have it just the way it is this time, basically, unless I change my mind. And then at 8:30 when we end, have an option for those of you who'd like to go to the library in the back and meet with a senior student to have a chance to talk to someone about your meditation experience, your questions about meditation, in a more focused way than maybe we can in the class. How many of you would be interested in doing that? If you came, like if you had come, if it happened this time around, you think you might have occasionally like to go back there and done that? Okay, yeah, so we'll probably do that next time. And
could you do it during the hour and a half and break up into smaller groups and have people ask questions in small groups?
We could do it, but I'm long-winded. What I've thought of doing is actually extending it to be 2 hours long. What do you think of that? So we should end. So thank you very much for this.